From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we touch base with Michigan's Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. Its members are being asked to ensure people of color in Michigan have political representation.
Majority-minority districts were created by the Voting Rights Act of 1965. You know, that act was signed by President Lyndon B. Johnson, and the main goal was to protect the voting rights of minority groups, specifically in the South.
We'll hear how it's playing out here and in some other states. Also, an extended conversation with the Detroit native whose supersized tweet thread about a road trip captivated hundreds of thousands of readers.
So it made sense at the time. And when she invited me, there were no red flags. I mean, she said who was going. She said how long. They were only going for the weekend. She had gone before. I had gone before. So I went.
The co-writer of the film Zola joins us. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, the incredibly true story of two Michigan sex workers, one road trip, and 148 tweets that told their story.
It was like if I tweeted it, it was in the film.
Today on the show, we're going to introduce you to Asia Zola King, whose social media narrative about a wild weekend in Tampa tells truths about sex work, race, and female friendship. That is coming up later on the show, and it is epic. But first, we need to catch up on what's happening with Michigan's Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. You remember, this is the group tasked by Michigan voters with redrawing the state's lines of political representation. Who you vote for in the next state and federal legislative elections will be decided by this nonpartisan group of just plain folks. The hope is that they'll be able to come up with a more equitable map for legislative representation than the partisan wrangling that's been the norm in Michigan for decades. But the commission does have to follow a few rules. Sergio Martinez Beltran, who reports for Bridge Michigan, has been following the commission's work, and we've invited him here to tell us about what he's noticed. Sergio, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Thanks for having me.
So the word that we usually use for this process is gerrymandering. And, you know, of course, this is a very negative term. It is something that political parties do to benefit their own interests and to try to build their own voting blocks. But there's another angle to drawing legislative boundaries to make sure that communities of color have a say in their representation. Can you talk to us a little bit about how this works and how it has worked?
Absolutely. And I think I'm about to give you a class real quick here, because it's a term that it's really important and that commissions and legislative bodies all across the country are actually paying attention to. And it's the so-called majority-minority district. And these are the districts where a minority group makes up at least 50% of the population. And, you know, this increases the likelihood of a candidate of their preference to be elected. So these majority-minority districts were created by the Voting Rights Act of 1965. That act was signed by President Lyndon B. Johnson, and the main goal was to protect the voting rights of minority groups, specifically in the South. So what does that mean? It means that in the state, the commission, the independent commission, is going to have to draw districts that, you know, ensure that the minority groups have power, that their voices are not diluted.
It's so funny that phrase majority-minority came about at a time when people of color truly were a minority in this country, but demographics are changing so quickly in the United States. I wonder how long we'll be using that phrase, but we are going to just use it for now because it's what's in the federal code. Where are Michigan's majority-minority districts right now?
So that's a great question. We have two majority-minority congressional districts. It's important to make that distinction because there could be majority-minority state legislative seats, for example, or school board seats. But we're talking here about congressional districts. So there's two, and that's the 13th congressional district, which is represented by Democrat Rashida Tlaib. And it's also the 14th congressional district represented by Brenda Lawrence. And these two districts are in Southeast Michigan. The interesting thing about this, it's that, you know, Michigan is about 26% non-white, and that's according to census estimates. And the majority of people of color live in Southeast Michigan, which is represented by these two. It's actually represented by seven mostly Democratic-leaning congressional districts. But the largest number of people of color in that region, April, are concentrated into those two majority-minority congressional districts, the 13th and the 14th. And you know, that can be a little complicated because experts say that that phenomenon of packing everyone or putting all the people of color in one or two districts is called packing, and that that can dilute the influence of minority. You know, 65% of the minority voters, just to give you an example, are in the 13th and 14th congressional districts, which is a big amount.
So there are pros and cons to this approach, to be sure. You've got these twin challenges for folks drawing the districts. We don't want to dilute the voices of people of color by scattering them among white voters. But it also seems not quite right to pack all the people of color into just a few districts. What are you hearing from experts about how the Redistricting Commission might approach this? Where do they even begin?
That's a great question. You know, I think that's the tension that experts are warning legislative bodies, and in the case of Michigan, the inaugural Redistricting Commission, you know, they're saying there is this tension because they do have an obligation to not use race as a determining factor when drawing districts. But at the same time, they want to make sure that minority groups have a voice and that their voices or their candidates of preference can be elected. So what they're recommending is that, you know, if the commission is starting to draw a majority-minority district, they're telling them, hey, do not use race as your only factor, because that would be unconstitutional and that would be in violation of the VRA. The other thing which is interesting here, and it's a little bit of math, but, you know, like I mentioned earlier, majority-minority districts are districts where minority groups make up at least 50%. Now, experts are saying, okay, you can make a majority-minority group, but make sure that the number of that minority group is around 51%, 52%, because then if it's a 59%, let's say, African-American district, that means that a lot of their votes are being wasted. Why? Well, because you only need 51% to technically win, right? Mm. So they're saying if you put 59, that's when you start diluting their voices and their votes.
Mm-hmm. Is there a blanket assumption that people who are of the same race means that folks are going to have common political interests? Or does there have to be some evidence beyond that in how the commission makes these decisions?
So we have all these assumptions, right? We think that Black folks vote a certain way, that Latinos vote a certain way. But the VRA and experts are saying you cannot make those assumptions when you're drawing a map. Mm. You have to use previous data. So you have to use election results from the last year, from primaries, from local elections, to try to identify how are people voting and what are the voting behaviors of these minority groups. And once you have identified those, then you can draw a map. But the reality is that, as we've seen in other states, the Latino community and the Black community, they're not a monolith. And so you're not just packing minorities, or you're not putting minority groups in a district just to put them in a district. You have to make sure that their voting behaviors and their voting is cohesive. And that's how you can also ensure that that district would not be unconstitutional.
I mean, this is just a lot. We should mention that the commission is also supposed to be considering the broader concept of communities of interest. Are the rules around race different than they might be for any other demographic category that they're looking at in Michigan?
No, not really. I do think that, you know, with communities of interest, this topic that they are also considering, and that it's third on the ranking criteria that the commission is using to draw maps. Communities of interest is this broad term that it means community groups that share a cultural, economic, or any other values. What we have identified and what we have seen is that many communities of interest are made up of people of color or minority groups, right? When we hear about Bangladesh, for example, those are Bangladesh community that wants to stay together. We've heard from Arab Americans. We've heard from African Americans in Detroit. We've heard from Latino groups in Western Michigan. So that's also, that adds a little bit another layer of complication, because they're also trying to ensure that communities of interest can stick together while also drawing this majority-minority districts and other districts. By the way, they have two right now, but let's keep in mind that we'll have the majority of the districts in the state are not majority-minority. You have districts that go from the Upper Peninsula to the Lower Peninsula that are predominantly white.
You made a reporting trip for this story out to Utah at a gathering of folks there who were involved with redistricting. Like you said, this is a national story going on in many, many states. What did you see there? What were the conversations going on about race and how it's going to factor into this round of redistricting?
It's fascinating. And I think what I found the most fascinating aspect of this is this idea of communities of interest, April, because many states have this idea of communities of interest embedded in their constitutions or in their redistricting plans, but they are not prioritized. In the case of Michigan, this is a priority for the commission to ensure that communities of interest are considered when drawing new maps. And, you know, I talked to a Republican expert from Ohio who said that, you know, this concept of communities of interest is evolving and that it could lead to challenges in the future because we don't have specific definitions of what it could mean. And also, it's just like a relatively new concept in terms of redistricting, especially for states who are prioritizing this. So that was very interesting. The other thing is that, you know, they are making sure that these experts that are drawing the maps, A, are not violating the Voting Rights Act, which is super important, mm-hmm. but also B, that if they get challenged and if they get sued, which, let's be clear here, it's likely that almost all the commissions and all the legislative bodies could get sued. If they get sued, that they are protected. And the way for these commissions to be protected is by making sure they have what we are calling their receipts, that they have their show and tell, and that they can justify that they didn't draw a majority minority district out of discrimination, but to ensure that these minority groups have a vote and have a voice.
We have less than a minute left here, but we should say that there have been Voting Rights Act rollbacks at the Supreme Court level. Do you get the sense that those challenges are very much on the mind of the people who are doing the work at the commission?
Oh, 100%. It's on the mind of the commission, and they want to make sure that they are doing the right thing. It's also on the mind of advocacy groups who have already warned the commission and other groups, hey, we are going to sue you if you hurt our minority groups.
It's just right out there in the room.
Yes.
Sergio Martinez Beltran reports for Bridge Michigan on politics, and you can read his story about Michigan's Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission on the Bridge website. Sergio, thank you so much. It's a great story.
Thank you so much.
We so appreciate having you tune in for Stateside every day. Let us know what's going on in your corner of the state. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Or send us an email. Our address is stateside@michiganradio.org. Up next, Asia Zola King talks about her time dancing in Detroit strip clubs and what sex work can do to a person's worldview.
As I got older, I realized it's like so many different layers to dancing. Because like I said, at 18, it was just like so much money was flying in. And I think that's when I started to like judge men in a different way. At 18, I didn't really fully grasp it.
That's after a break. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. 2021 has itself a hit indie film this summer. Zola premieres for video on demand today. It's based on a true story that's adapted from a lengthy tweet thread by my guest, Asia Zola King. It tells how a 19-year-old waitress and stripper from Detroit made a new friend named Jessica and tagged along for what she thought would be a lucrative weekend dancing in Tampa clubs. What she got was a brush with sex trafficking, guns, and mayhem.
Hey, last month I went dancing at this cute spot in Florida where my roommate's girl made like 5 G's a night. My roommate just told me that he going out there tomorrow, and he asked me if I had any friends that want to make some money, and you the first bitch I thought of.
Damn, bitch. We just met yesterday and you already trying to take hoe trips together?
This story has had a long, weird journey to the screen, but the director Janixa Bravo has now delivered it as a stunning film with smart takes on sex work, race, and female friendship. One word of warning, Zola is not a family film, and we will be discussing sex work in this conversation. Asia Zola King is a writer and a mother of two who now lives in Georgia. You know she's still tweeting, and you can follow her online. Zola, welcome to Stateside.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Can we start just by talking about your life before you met this woman, Jessica, and before this crazy road trip in the story happened? You were waitressing and dancing and tweeting. You just tell us a little more about where you're living and what you're up to.
I was in Detroit at the time. Well, I was actually outside of Detroit, but when I say Roswell, nobody knows. So I was in Detroit, Michigan, and I was waitressing, like you said, at different bars, but really Hooters, and I was dancing at night, like every night. Just at different clubs in the city. And sometimes I travel. I did Florida a lot. I did North Carolina a lot. I did Atlanta a few times. And yeah, that was it. I was dating. I was in a very serious relationship at the time. I was engaged.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of just what was going on.
When and how did you start dancing in clubs?
On my 18th birthday, I both got a job at this club. It was called Penthouse. I think they're still open in Detroit. And I also got hired at Hooters on my 18th birthday. So kind of like funny story, but not really. It's just how it happened. I had been waiting. I was still in high school, actually. And I had been waiting because I turned 18 in March and then we didn't graduate until May. So I had been like waiting to turn 18 because I wanted to work at Hooters. Like I felt it was like, I don't know, seems like they had this sisterhood, like this sorority type situation. And I was like, I didn't have many friends in school. So I was like, I want to go work at Hooters. Like I need, you know, some friends. I think Hooters will do that for me. And so on my 18th birthday, my mom took me to Hooters and they hired me like on the spot. And then that same night, again, on my 18th birthday, the same day, my best friend at the time, she drove me to the club. She drove me to Penthouse. I was like, I think I want to dance too. Like, I'm just going to try it all. And same thing. They hired me on the spot. I had no idea what I was doing. Clearly, like, I'm a child. What am I even doing here? But, you know, they also hired me on the spot at 18. And that was it.
You know, that sisterhood that you're talking about, that's something that you know, you hear from people who work in the industry. And it really comes across in the movie, too. There's that amazing scene at the club in Tampa when the dancers are sort of having a moment of prayer together that is both funny and it's like really, it's kind of emotional, too. And anybody, you know, knows that dancing can be really lucrative work, but obviously it has its issues. What did you see of strip club culture and dancing in the time that you were working in Detroit?
Well, like you said, there is a sisterhood, but that I realized came from just, I guess, sex work in general, not necessarily dancing. Because, I mean, I had gotten to camming. Like I said, I was working at Hooters, which isn't necessarily sex work. But a lot of the girls that I worked with at Hooters, I also worked with at the club. So you just kind of started to see this very specific realm that we all committed and existed in. And so with that, we just naturally had each other's back. It's like if you see a girl every day for the last 2 years at your job, it's like you guys kind of become a thing. Everyone kind of becomes family. So I saw that. As I got older, I realized it's like so many different layers to dancing. Because like I said, at 18, it was just like so much money was flying in. And I think that's when I started to like judge men in a different way. At 18, I didn't really fully grasp it. But then like 20, 21, 22 came about and the money slowed down intensely. I mean, when I stopped, when men would say, how old are you? And I could no longer say 18, their faces and moods changed. And I was like, oh, this is a thing. Like, oh, men are weird. Okay, got it. So at that point, I just played, I don't know, I guess I just learned how to play up the fantasy. And that's when I finally realized sex work is, it's work for me, but it's fantasy for so many other people. And that's just, it's something that I wouldn't have been able to figure out had I not had the experience.
There is an amazing scene in the film where Taylor Page, who's playing you, basically, she does a dance on the pole, and it is just incredible. It's very sensual, and it's pretty athletic, too. And you can just tell this is someone who's putting some work and thought and feeling into what she's doing. And this dude in the front row leans in, and he's a white guy, and he says, "You look so much like Whoopi Goldberg." It's just like, oh, did you have experiences like that?
Of course. I mean, even outside of dancing, but yes, absolutely. And it'd be the most ridiculous. I mean, sometimes it'd be flattering. I mean, I'd hear, like, you look like Beyonce, when we all f***ing know I do not look like Beyonce. Like, thank you, but, like, come on. And so it wouldn't always be that dramatic, but, I mean, it'd be, it's like any black woman they can think of, that's what I look like. Like, no freaking way. So, yes, that happens.
Yeah, yeah. You danced at a couple different kinds of places, too, both geographically and within cities. What were some of the differences that you observed in different kinds of clubs?
Oh, my God. So I think that the fact that I started dancing in Detroit really helped. I think if you can survive dancing in Detroit, you can dance anywhere, because I learned once I began to travel that anything goes in our clubs. Like, and I couldn't believe it when I'd go to some of these other clubs and I'd see the rules written on the front door and the paperwork you had to sign and the permits they need. I was like, what? Like, back home, all you got to do, you go down to the courthouse, you get a background check. I mean, they want to make sure you're not like a psycho, right? And then that's it.
Right.
You get a picture and you can work in the club. That's it. Be 18, get a background check, get your ID. The end, you can work. Either if you want to work at a full new club, fine. If not, fine. Like, whatever. We had back rooms, which we know they're illegal, but like, I mean, we had plenty of cops who would come in and hang out, and they didn't give a shit. Like, Detroit is just such a different world. Like, and we all know what's going on in the back room. Some girls are dancing, some girls are not. Like, we know.
Yeah.
No one cares. Like, it's just, that's what's happening in the clubs. When I went to, I think I was in North Carolina. It was this huge, one of the biggest clubs I ever worked at. It was called Platinum Plus. And that was the first time first of all, there were no back rooms, of course, because they're illegal. But the room that they did allow dances, one-on-one dances to be given, men were not allowed to touch you. That was crazy to me. I'm like, well, I mean, I like that, but like, what? Like, anyone touching anyone, $500 fine. Like, what? I mean, it was so, the stage was maybe 5 feet away from the closest chair, and you could not come any closer. I don't know. It was, for me, it was like, this is the type of stripping that I see on TV. Like, this is really what's happening. Like, in back home, it's so much more personal. And so that was something that varied from state to state, the rules, the amount of nudity, just the culture in itself. Again, back home, like I said, it's much more personal. You develop like genuine relationships with your customers, mostly because you have to, because if you don't, yeah, you probably will never see them again, and you probably won't make much money, and you probably won't last at this club for long. Out of state, even down in Florida, I mean, when you're out of state dancing, I realize you really don't got to talk to anybody. They know what they're coming to the club for, and they're going to spend $1,000 whether you talk to them or you don't. And so that's just something that I learned through traveling.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Asia Zola King. She is the co-writer and executive producer on the new film Zola. So it's 2015, and there you are in Metro Detroit. You're working at Hooters, and this woman named Jessica walks in, and you guys start to talk in, and she says, do you want to come down to Tampa with me? And the idea is to work at some clubs for the weekend and make some serious money. And this is what led to you coming back to Detroit soon with this incredible story to tell. It's easy to look at the circumstances in hindsight and say, red flags here. But I just kept thinking, you know, this woman was 19. What was going on? What made you think, I'm just going to do it? I'm just going to go?
Again, we as sex workers and as dancers, that's what we do. I mean, that wasn't my first girls trip. That wasn't the first time I met someone and the next day we're in a car together or on an airplane. That wasn't the first. I mean, we'd even do things at the strip club where all the dancers would, you know, go out on a Saturday after working. We'd go to an after hours, and then we'd end up at one of the girls' house who we don't even know her. We have no idea who this girl is, but we're at her house and we're staying the night and we're all having a sleepover in her basement sharing our sex work stories. I mean, like I said, it's like a sorority. Like, that's what we do. So it was never, there were no red flags to me. I mean, I would have did that. If I met someone and I vibed with them and I knew I was going out of town the next day, I'd invite them. I mean, so again, if you don't exist in this realm or this line of work, sure, maybe it sounds weird to you, but that's what we do. So it made sense at the time. And when she invited me, there were no red flags. I mean, she said who was going. She said how long. They were only going for the weekend. She had gone before. I had gone before. So I went.
Who's all going?
Me, my boyfriend, and my roommate. Last time I was there, I met a rapper who had a song on the radio.
Hey, who is that?
Text me your address.
You just dropped me off the other night.
You think I remember, b***h? I don't know where I am right now.
I'm gonna have to b***h my b***h calm.
Cute.
Yo, what's that look on your face?
I'm going to Florida to dance.
Since when?
I think a lot of people assume that anyone who dances will do sex work. And the film explores how that line can be porous, but that there's a lot to who's making the decisions. Can you tell us a little bit about what you experienced in that world about, you know, just how much power you had to decide, you know, how far you were going to go and how much you saw other women having the opportunity to make that choice for themselves?
Well, first, I would like to clarify that sex work in itself is just a blanket term. Anyone who works in a realm where sex is being sold in any capacity is working in sex work. I mean, even the bouncers at the club, even the valet have cabaret licenses. Okay, so even the bartender, yeah. So that they're all sex workers. All of us together, this existing simultaneously, this culture is sex work.
Can I just say, like, I've met dancers who did identify what they do as sex work, and dancers who didn't. Where do you fall in that?
It's all sex work. Maybe they have some type of shame, but by definition, it is sex work. Like I said, the bouncer is a sex worker by definition. Like, so I am a sex worker, yes. However, I think that since the topic of sex work gets this bad reputation for, you know, for whatever reason, it has this bad rep. I actually think the reason is because it's so maybe close to what people assume is sex trafficking. And that's the problem. You know, the difference between these two things is consent. And that also is highlighted in this film. I mean, I've never, you know, when this story first came out, people assumed I was lying. They assumed, you know, I was terrified of the pimp. So why wouldn't I, you know, sell sex? I mean, they assumed so many things. And, you know, I have no problem clarifying these things, but I just think the fact that women, you know, standing their ground and remaining, you know, voice over themselves and claiming their agency in any situation, the fact that that is even questioned is crazy to me. What Jessica was doing on that trip and before that trip is sex work. That is, she consented. That is what she likes doing. That is how she makes her money. That is where she's comfortable. That is what she does. What I did before that trip was sex work. Now, when I got, you know, lured, I will say, on this trip, and they attempted to remove my consent in the work, that is when I'm now in a sex trafficking situation. And that is something, that is the topic that needs to be talked about. That's something that, you know, is an issue within the culture and needs to completely be spoken on and cracked down on. I mean, consent is key in every aspect, even in just your personal sexual relationships where there's no work involved. Consent is the only reason. So, you know, they tried to remove my consent, and that is where the issue came from.
So what happens is you went down to Florida with this girl, Jessica, and in the movie, her character is called Stephanie. It gets a little confusing, but we'll probably go back and forth as we go forward. And this guy, who she said was her roommate, turns out to be her pimp. And you explain, you know, how you found that out. He's played by Coleman Domingo in the film, and his character is just mostly referred to as X.
What's this for?
Respect.
So I can go home now?
Nah. I'm gonna need you to do what you did last night.
I appreciate your confidence in me, but I came to dance.
Oh, no, we're done with that.
Oh, well, in that case, I'm gonna sit my right here. And if you don't mind, you in my sunlight.
I'm in your sunlight. Watch your mouth before you speak to me. Watch it.
Miss, may I help
She don't
you?
Need any help.
Miss.
She doesn't need any help.
I'm good.
I've always been strong and had my standards for myself. And that's what I tell girls, younger girls who want to dance or who are already dancing. I just say have your set of boundaries because you don't want... It is very easy to lose yourself in this realm. And, I mean, imagine if I would have been so terrified that I allowed these strangers to remove my agency over my body and remove my consent. And now I have this trauma attached to me forever because I was just... so terrified that I allowed these men to use my body however they choose. Absolutely not. That was never an option for me. Ever. Ever. Never, ever, ever, ever. And so, you know, I tell girls, I'm just like, have your set of boundaries and stick to them. And for me, one of my boundaries have always been if my full consent is not in it, I'm not in it. And I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get myself out of it. So that's what I did in that situation. I knew that he just wanted money. That's all that pay. He wanted money.
We're going to continue my conversation with Asia Zola King in just a minute and hear more about the racial dynamics that Zola was getting at with her story and how the movie handles them. We'll be right back. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking to Asia Zola King today. She's originally from Detroit, and she's the author of a storied 2015 tweet thread about a road trip to Florida that went sideways. At the time, she was a waitress and also danced in strip clubs. She's now a writer and a mother of two living in Georgia. The story's been adapted into a new film that got a lot of attention at the Sundance Film Festival. The film was directed by Janixa Bravo and co-written by Zola and by the playwright Jeremy O. Harris. It premieres for video on demand today. Just a reminder that this conversation will include subjects like sex work, and it may not be appropriate for all listeners. Zola's trip began when she met another dancer named Jessica. In the film, this character is called Stephanie, and she's white. And during the trip, she keeps slipping in and out of a strong black scent.
I swear on my life. I swear on my mama's life. I was like, what? Like, huh? Like, this dookie ass with a nappy tail was up in my face.
The actress who plays Stephanie, Riley Keough, has talked about building the character and especially the way that her character talks, learning to speak like a white girl who's trying to quote-unquote sound black. You know, she's got a strong black scent that just the minute she opens her mouth, it's like, okay, whoa. And in the film, it's a pretty quick tip-off that there's something deeply off about her. Was that how Jessica, the actual person, was that how she talked when you met her?
When I met her, no. And that's the part that was so, so funny. When I first met her, no, she talked like herself. There was nothing out of the ordinary about the way that she spoke. And it wasn't until she was around her pimp and me and that her voice, that the black scent revealed itself. You know, I was taken back, but now I'm already in the car. We're here. We're leaving, right? Like, I don't know what's going on. And so I think that was maybe her way of connecting to him. I don't know. You know, some people like that, they get around their black friends and they want to be more like their black friends. And then they get around the white friends and they want to be more like their white friends. And, you know, so I think that's what she was doing. It's like, it was like the more black people that was in the room, the deeper the black scent got. And I'm like, I don't even talk like that. Like, what's going on here? But once we were in the car on the way to Florida, when the rap music was playing and she was dropping the N-bombs and she was, you know, around him, absolutely.
It feels in the movie like maybe what Stephanie's trying to do is use language as a sort of equalizing force in the movie. You know, that dancers or sex workers of any background or race, you know, have something together. But then we find out in the movie that not everybody does have things on an equal playing field. And this white girl is willing to present herself as a victim in a way that there's this whole scene where we understand that Jessica/Stephanie has responded to your story with her own Reddit thread and just completely recasts what's going on and puts herself in as the victim. It was kind of a power play, you know, to say, hey, we're just the same, to try to get trust out of you. Is that pretty common, do you think?
It is pretty common, and especially in a relationship like that, where there's a black girl and a white girl, and we're becoming friends, and especially in that situation, it'll seem like one way or the other, they will try to bond a bit more than they really need to, because what she failed to realize was the reason why I'm on this trip and why I even trusted you enough to give you my number and my address and get in the car with you to go on the other side of the country is because you were already my sister when you said, hey, girl, I'm a sex worker, I'm a dancer, I'm a mother. That mm-hmm. There was a period at the end of that. You didn't need to go above and beyond. There was nothing else that could have bonded us any closer. And she, for, you know, that disconnect, she just didn't understand that. There was nothing that she could have said that would have made me trust her anymore. Everything else that came after is what made me distrust her. So, mm-hmm. She lost me there. And I think that with her response, it just shows in that type of relationship, because I honestly think that if I would have been a white girl and I would have told my truth and gone viral the way I did, I don't think half the amount of people that were like, is she telling the truth? Is this really what happened? I don't think they would have questioned me the same. I mean, I've seen people go viral mm-hmm. for story times and other things all the time, and never are we like, is this video is a setup, or this story is a, never. We laugh, we're entertained, it's viral, it's a moment, and we're on to the next thing next week. We never closely analyze these viral moments, and so it was like, why do I have to be lying? And the topic of race then comes up. And then with her telling her version of this story, I mean, she really just piggybacked off of everything that I said, but then switched, like you said, switched the roles. It was me who was doing that. And she also made herself extremely more aggressive towards me in her, I don't know if you read her Reddit version, but she made herself.
I did.
Oh my, she made her, like, she told me to shut the hell up, and she threw things at me, like, and so it was so dramatic in the way that she switched it, and it was so offensive. And then, yes, I opened the line with, do you want to hear how me and this white bitch here fell out, right? But I was not being racial to be negative towards her, like her downfalls are because she's white. No, I'm just describing, she was a white bitch. Like, that's it. But I wasn't playing up on race to say, you know, that's what the issue is. That's what the disconnect was, yes, but that wasn't the issue. And so her, in her version, it's like, I'm dirty and my wig's nappy. And her, the way that she used race and the way that I used race in my experience was so different. And it just got really dark and really offensive really quickly. People recognized that.
What were some of the ways that you saw the director of the film, Janixa Bravo, and Jeremy O'Harris, who was your co-writer, what were some of the ways that you saw them sort of honoring your story and maybe kind of answering that disbelief that some people had in the online version of it?
I like and appreciated the fact that they stuck to my thread so true. It was like if I tweeted it, it was in the film. And even when it came to verbatim lines that I tweeted, you would hear the Twitter chime go off in the movie. I mean, that was an amazing touch to me. I think that also with the thread coming out in 2015, Janixa really captured the energy of 2015, if that makes sense. When you see the film, you'll understand. But if I think that when I watch it, every time I watch it, I feel like I'm back in 2015. I mean, there were certain things that Janixa and I talked about in private, obviously, that made its way into the film that wasn't in the thread, but she was still able to capture the feeling of those moments. For example, the scene with the group of guys who had called, they wanted a couple girls, they were talking about a gangbang, and it was like eight of them. Well, in real life, I didn't tweet that. I told Janixa about it, but that's only because Stephanie's Reddit, she talked about it. That was the darkest moment of the trip for me. It was so dark and it was so heavy. And I think that's the only moment I was terrified, honestly.
Yeah, it is a very dark moment in the film as
and
well.
And I think she painted it perfectly. Again, I think that is where she was able to, because, I mean, it was so dark in real life that maybe even too dark for film, but she did very good capturing that energy. I think every time that part comes on, the entire theater gets very quiet, and I think we're all feeling the exact same.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Asia Zola King, the co-writer of the new movie, Zola. It is also a basic truth that sometimes we as women look for friends who are, shall we say, a little on the scary side. That this was definitely a vibe that I got watching the movie. What do you think that's about?
Scary side, like how? What do you mean?
Well, the girl who will say what, like, maybe we ourselves won't say, or the girl who looks like we ourselves don't look. You know, someone who just like pushes the envelope a little farther. Do you agree? Do you think that's true?
I've experienced that, but I've been the one who's been the reason for that. I've never gone out seeking that. Like I said, I think I just look for reflections in my friendships. Like if you know, if I understand you or I relate to you or I am inspired by you, we can go out, girl. We can be friends. But on the flip side of things, I've come to realize a lot of times that girls do befriend me for that reason. Girls befriend me because they know I'm going to be the one to speak up. Or they know that if we go out tonight and, you know, they're talking to a guy 2 seconds too long and he ain't offered to buy my girl no drink, I'm going to tell his to get to stepping. But they won't. Right. I'm going to, and they like that. And so, you know, it's kind of a win-lose for me because I oftentimes try to press that and rub it off on them. Like, so maybe when I'm not here, you too can say what you need to say. And I think same thing with Stephanie. Before I came into the picture, I mean, she was, I don't make the prices. Whatever my pimp says goes. And I'm like, girl, your pimp is not the one in here working. Like, absolutely not. It's whatever you say goes. But again, I think that's what other women look for in friendship with me. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't mind it.
Yeah. And I understand that, like, you say you felt that the level of danger in real life in Tampa was not really what we see in the movie as far as your, you know, how you were feeling about the whole thing. But in the movie, Taylor Page's Zola stays with Stephanie when the situation starts getting out of control and didn't leave her, even though she's getting to the point where she really doesn't like this woman very much anymore.
That is actually how it happened. And I had spoken to both Taylor and Janixa about that. I guess just that feeling. So again, I keep bringing up this sisterhood and the sense of community. Part of me still was a bit unsure on where she stood. I was still kind of unsure. I wasn't sure if she was a victim. I wasn't sure if she was manipulated. I mean, I've been around women with pimps before. I mean, like I said, I had been dancing and working in sex work for a year at this point. So I had seen, you know, girls with pimps. I had gone to trips with girls with pimps before. But they had never tried to force anything on me. But I have seen this dynamic where the man's in control and the woman's a bit brainwashed or manipulated, or she thinks she's his top girl, and that's just not the case. And I mean, I've seen so many different dynamics of this type of relationship that I was still unsure what kind they had, honestly. And so I didn't want to leave her. And then I look on the news tomorrow and who knows what happened in Florida. And, you know, and all that could have stopped that would have been maybe her as another sex worker being with her. Basically, all she said to me in real life was that she didn't want to be on the trip by herself. She invited me because she didn't want to be the only woman in the room. So she pulled the feminist card out. She did. I was like, okay, maybe she does need my help.
Since the film went into development, have you seen Jessica or anybody else from the trip?
Yeah. So I was friends with everyone still on Facebook for the longest. Once the tweets went viral, and I think maybe I don't know if production had started or if just a rewrite had started. Because, you know, there's a different version of this that we don't probably like as much.
The James Franco version, yeah.
Yeah, there's a version we're not too happy about, yeah. And I think that that version was being written or finished or shopped around. And somehow Jessica got in contact with some people. And she wasn't too happy about how she was being portrayed, although, I mean, I could only portray her based off of what she showed me. So she wanted to sue me, actually. And we went to court. And she sued me. She said that I outed her as a sex worker. Totally not true. And that was the last time I seen her, when she attempted to sue me. And at that point, she actually signed paperwork that said she would never talk about this story again, and she would never, like, it's mine, it's my experience. She can speak on her own experience, but the Zola story she can no longer attach herself to, whether it's in write, film, whatever. And she happily signed, so thanks, girl. Yeah, and I know her pimp. I think he has maybe one more year before he's eligible for parole, because he got like 15 or 16 years for trafficking and assault, rape. That was a scary man. So that's the last I've heard of them.
You've always been a pretty open person in your social media persona, but this whole thread was just so, I think, unprecedented. I mean, people tell crazy stories on Twitter all the time, but this was so next level. And, you know, Jeremy and Janixa have both talked about it as like, this is great American novel narrative. And there's just so much in there. But at the same time, it was really, it exposed a lot of things, not just about everybody you went on the trip with, but, you know, about your life, too. And some people might have been a little less willing to share. You said that you wanted people to understand what had happened, you know, with someone trying to manipulate you. But why did you decide to do this in the detail that you did?
This was my third time speaking on this experience on the internet, actually. I had a blog back in 2015 that I briefly talked about it on. And then I had another Twitter that I briefly talked about it on. But I was still processing the experience. The first time I put this on the internet, I had literally only been home 12 hours. Like, I got off the plane, got home, showered, told my family what happened, cried, went to my blog. And so in that headspace, nothing's funny, right? It's one of those things like, yeah, maybe we can laugh about it later, but I'm not laughing right now. So in my shakily moment, I just, you know, told my blog followers, like, you guys, you have to be careful out here. People aren't who they say they are. I just went through this really weekend. I'm okay. You know, hashtag pray for me or some like, it was very like that. And so then months later, I think I went to Twitter and again, very briefly, still processing. I was like, hey, you know, this, you know, I spoke on this on my blog. This is what happened. But again, I didn't go in detail. Now, when I finally decided to go into detail, I had just come across a picture of Stephanie and I at the club in real life. I come across a picture from Facebook, and this was before either of us told anything. And so when I saw her picture, I was like, you know what? And I started talking to my mom, actually, and I was like, I think I should tell the internet, like, what really happened. Does that sound like a good idea? And my mom, she was like, go ahead. Why not? Like, you know, why not? And that was maybe 6 months later, because this happened in March. This was October. So I'm like, you know, I'm over it. I'm you know, I think I can finally really get in detail and talk about how crazy this was. Because there was moments where even on the trip in real life, I did laugh. Like, there were dark moments that I think people would be entertained by. And I also think that I also want people to know this type of shit happens all the time. So that's just what triggered it. I seen that picture. I was, you know, briefly talking about it with my mom. And as I'm recapping the story to her, she's laughing. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to the internet with it. And then that's what I did, just straight off the top of my head. I didn't write anything down or plan it out. I just told it exactly how it happened. And then the engagement of Twitter, because, you know, Twitter's instant. It just felt like theater, and like I had this live audience. And so then I had to finish it. And that was it.
Asia Zola King is the co-writer and executive producer of the film Zola, which premieres on video on demand this week. She's the author of the original tweet thread that you know as The Story. She has been so generous with her time. Zola, it's really, really been a pleasure talking with you. We can't wait to see what projects you're going to be working on next.
Thank you so much.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Bye-bye.